The Trumpet Daily Program begins right now.
Today's world news, what it means, where it's taking us.
I bring you the one and only possible message of world peace.
This is a message of hope, tremendous hope. And he said unto me, you must prophesy again.
The Trumpet Daily Program begins right now.
Hello and welcome to the Trumpet Daily Radio Show. This is Richard Palmer standing in for your regular host, Mr. Stephen Flurry. Well, breaking news here from the UK. Summer is hot. Here's an introductory clip to tell you a bit about it. Clip zero.
I can say that the extreme heat we're forecasting right now is absolutely unprecedented. We've seen, when climate change has driven such unprecedented severe weather events all around the world, it can be difficult for people to make the best decisions in these situations because nothing in their life experience has led them to know what to expect. Here in the UK, we're used to treating a hot spell as a chance to go and play in the sun. This is not that sort of weather. Our lifestyles and our infrastructure are not adapted to what is coming. Please treat the warnings we are putting out as seriously as you would a red or amber warning from us for wind or snow.
Well, that's the latest from the Met Office. The UK media is really going bananas over here about the weather, I guess. You know, the fact that there is this big yellow orb in the sky giving us a lot of heat is pretty big news. We do tend to be unfamiliar with it. The sky, of course, is normally completely shrouded in clouds. But now we have that yellow orb, the sun shining down on us. We're not quite sure what to do with it. In this post-COVID world, you don't have a weather forecast that says, all right, it's going to be a little bit hot out there. Enjoy the weather, drink plenty of water, but go out and have fun. No, instead, it's got to be the end of the world. Well, welcome, as I said, to the Trumpet Daily Show. I'm standing in from our Edstone studio here in the beautifully sunny Edstone, England. I have been very much enjoying this warm weather for a change. I mean, summer's always has some good warm weather, but you've got to enjoy those properly sunny days. We don't get them super, super often. Here in our Edstone studio, we're going out around the world on our website, thetrumpet.com. We're on Facebook, we're on CRN Digital Talk Radio, on CRN3, on various other platforms, and of course on 101.3 on the FM dial in the Edmond, Oklahoma region. Well, we are having a lot of completely over-the-top warnings, and there is a real agenda behind it. You can't, like I said, just have a like it used to happen when we had normal heat waves and it was just go out and enjoy yourself. We've got the post-COVID world. The government has got, everything's got to be a crisis, everything's got to be risky. There are extreme heat warnings everywhere. There's signs on the motorway. I was driving to the beach on Sunday, got signs on the motorway saying stay at home, it's hot, don't go out. You've got trade unions saying, well, workplaces have to close. I'm almost expecting the government to put us in lockdown. It is kind of bizarre. I mean, you heard the clip that we started the show with, where that woman is like, well, your past experience does not equip you to deal with the heat that's coming. It's kind of like, well, yeah, it is a little bit hotter than it gets than normal, but it is summer. We do occasionally have hot days in summer, and I think it was a record, but it's only marginally a record. We've certainly had days that felt similar to this before. So that's the post-COVID world. Everything has got to be a crisis. Everything's got to be something for the government to come in and tell you what to do. And of course, this gels in exactly with the whole climate change movement, where the climate change fanatics want the government to run your life anyway. The solution to climate change is always big government, is always more government interference, and that's exactly what That's exactly what they're saying here. You know, if you have a cold day in winter and you joke, oh, you know, what happened to global warming? Well, then everyone jumps on you. You know, climate does not equal weather. Don't confuse one day's weather for climate change, etc. But we get a hot day here and suddenly global warming is everywhere. I just saw a headline just while I was listening to the news for the show. Climate change denial is melting before our eyes. You cannot fight this heat. You know, talking about how, well, we have one hot day and this is convincing everybody that climate change is real. So again, cold day in winter, not enough to say global warming is false. One hot day in summer, absolutely, you've got to believe in climate change. And here was Prince Charles, for example. This was him basically saying exactly the same thing yesterday.
Lieutenant, ladies and gentlemen, I rather suspected that the Lord Lieutenant wouldn't be able to resist the opportunity to draw his sword for yet another cake. But I'm enormously grateful to him for his very kind words. And above all, I sympathize with you all having to put up with this inordinate heat, which is really rather typically British, rather a mad dog's an Englishman going out in the midday sun moment. But you're very resilient and courageous. In the development of Nansley, as well as in the Duchy's new regenerative agricultural practices, it will help us to meet, we hope, our net zero carbon commitments. We've only been able to make what progress we have by working in partnership with our tenants, our suppliers, and the people of Cornwall. If I may say so, these commitments around net zero have never been more vitally important as we all swelter under today's alarming record temperatures across Britain and Europe. And as I've tried to indicate for quite some time, the climate crisis really is a genuine emergency, and tackling it is utterly essential.
Climate change is a genuine emergency. You know, this hot weather proves we've got to do something. You know, he's not the only one here. This is a clip. This is from a climate protester. He's angry with the media because the media dare show people enjoying themselves in the hot weather. This is clip two.
Hi, are you okay to explain why you've taken action here today?
Hi, yes. So it's the hottest day of the year. Temperatures are breaking records in the UK and across the world. This is causing people are dying. And you would hope that newspapers would take responsibility for giving the public information that they need to keep themselves safe. And News UK have consistently been printing articles like we see here of people like happy in the sun and like women in bikinis and totally making light of the situation. They're absolutely not providing people with the information that they need. Ultimately, we need to stop using fossil fuels as quickly as possible because this situation is escalating. I'm a scientist. The scientist has been clear on that for decades.
How dare they show people enjoying themselves in this weather? How dare you show people happy in the sun? It's got to be doom. It's got to be only doom. If you have seen any of the UK media now, it's doom everywhere. There's climate apocalypse, etc. But apparently it's too positive for that expert, that scientist. You have to be telling people that you need to destroy the economy right now. I saw this article today from Laura Dodsworth. It's titled, "The Forecast is Nudging to Net Zero." And she connects some really interesting dots. But she mentions that in June 2018, you had similar temperatures being forecast to what we're having right now. I mean, it isn't every summer that it gets this hot, but at the same time, it's not fantastically unusual for us to actually have a good summer. This article says a video showed images of a sunny sky, a beach, and deck chairs. There were no exclamation marks, health warnings, or alarmist language. We didn't used to cover hot summers like this. Summer being hot was kind of barely the news. I mean, okay, we've set a record that is newsworthy, but a lot of hyperbole. This article then went on to talk about a paper that the government's nudge unit and the broadcaster Sky put out called The Power of TV, Nudging Viewers to Decarbonize Their Lifestyles, an evidence-based guide for broadcasters. So here you have a document being put out by a jointly between the government and a leading news broadcaster in the UK saying, this is how we believe you should cover climate change issues. I mean, the coverage all around climate change, all around weather, is being driven by it's being driven by the government, by what the government wants people to say, what the government wants people to hear. And so that's proven. They're putting out these documents saying, well, this is how we want you to cover these news stories. The government says, or this government and news broadcaster document says, mass media such as television can play a pivotal role in encouraging consumers to decarbonize. The majority of future emissions reductions, 63%, will need to come from changes in how we travel, how we power and heat our homes, what we eat and what we buy. It only seems logical that broadcasters should use their unique platform to improve viewers' knowledge, change their attitudes, and inspire them to take action against climate change. And so you have this selective broadcasting when it comes to weather. You know, they had, I think it was even in the top of the hour, they were talking about excess deaths in the heat. And true, yeah, you do get some more deaths than usual when the weather's hot. What they don't mention, though, is that you get an estimated 10,000 excess deaths in the UK each year due to cold winters. They don't talk about that. They talk about the ones that suit their narrative. This hot day, like I said, a hot day is proof of global warming. And to listen to them, you'd believe the UK is pushing out tons of pollution, tons of carbon. I just discovered this today, and I found it was pretty shocking. And you never hear this anywhere. If you look at how the UK has actually dramatically cut carbon emissions. So UK carbon emissions right now, they are at historic lows. Okay, how historic? How far do you have to go back to find when the UK was outputting less carbon than we're doing right now? Not the 90s, not the 80s, not the 70s, not the 60s, not the 40s. The last time carbon emissions were lower than they are today is 1888. You have to go all the way back to when Victoria, Queen Victoria, was ruling to find a time where we were putting out less carbon into the atmosphere. And that's not per capita, that's total. So Britain has done a ton to cut carbon. I should have sent the guys a graphic to put up, but you can find graphics and there's been a rapid decline since the 2000s, the last 20 years or so. Britain has massively reduced carbon emissions. And yet there's all this hysteria about how, well, we need to shut down the country more. We need to do more. Now, of course, there are weather curses, and we are seeing an increase in drought. We're seeing an increase in wildfires around the world. There are some pretty serious wildfires going on in Spain, in France. So there are curses coming on the weather, and there are droughts and things like that coming on the weather. So I don't want to necessarily play down the story too much. I'm not sure we're quite in, I don't think we're in like a historic drought territory yet in the UK. I've certainly seen it where we've gone longer without rain. We don't even have hose pipe bans or anything like that at the moment. But those kind of weather curses are coming. And of course, you'll see people blaming those on global warming. It's a ready-made excuse. It really is interesting just to see how more and more dangerous this has become. And again, tomorrow's news today, you can go back and see where Trumpet editor-in-chief Gerald Flurry has been writing for years about the true agenda behind the climate change movement. And I think it was he has one article, it's not in my notes, but I think it's what the Paris Climate Change Agreement is really all about. And that goes through how, this Paris Climate Change Agreement was a tool for bringing down the United States. I think that was 2016, 2017, but all of the whole movement has really gotten a lot worse since then and is doing so much more to try and bring down Britain and America. But it brings it down these by, telling us, well, we've got to shut down all of our industry to approve Mother Nature. We've got to stop drilling. We need to beg Saudi Arabia to keep drilling, but we've got to shut down our drilling due to climate change. you know, we've got to, we need to act on this. Now, it's dangerous in that respect. It's also dangerous, though, in this respect, is when we do see these weather curses come, where we do see these weather curses that are predicted in great detail in the Bible and that actually match what we're seeing much more closely than these climate change models that have constantly gotten things wrong. As we do see those weather curses hit, well, people just blame it on global warming instead. And they say, well, we have to fix our climate sins instead of going back and repenting towards God. So another way that it is a deadly, dangerous deception. Now, I didn't want to spend a huge amount of time on that subject. It has just been annoying me how all of a sudden we are so fragile that we cannot handle a hot day. Of course, being British, I've still got to get my obligatory complaint about the weather out there away here. It is still a bit uncomfortably hot. It is nearly 90 degrees. And that's not outside. That's in this room. I think it's about 86, 87 degrees. I think my office is about 96 degrees. So, it is pretty hot when you don't have air conditioning. But at the same time, we complain so much because of the rain. We complain so much because of the cold, because of the cloudiness. I think we've lost our right to complain when it's sunny, and we should just enjoy it. But the net zero and this talk of climate change, it does allow me to segue quickly to a bit of an update on the UK leadership election. Like I talked about last time I was on the show, we're in the process of choosing a new prime minister. Just about all of those candidates are committed to net zero. You know, this is the leader of the right-wing Conservative Party, and they are all sticking to a radical environmental plan. I think probably more radical than anything Joe Biden has talked about in the United States. It's like our right-wing party is more left-wing than America's left-wing. Don't quote me on that. That might not be the case across everything, but it certainly seems like that. You know, we've got this cost of living crisis, partly because half of our energy bills are going in tax, half of our fuel bills are going in tax, and a lot of those taxes are going to green subsidies. Yet still every single one of them just about is talking about the need to cut emissions. It really is just such a powerful tool for bringing down Israel. But I thought I'd spend a few minutes to update you on this process of choosing a new leader. I find it fairly amusing. It feels like a game show. You have a long, long list of candidates, and then each day we have a new vote and somebody else gets evicted. And we just kind of you get to the end of the news day and it's like, okay, who has been voted off the contest of I want to be Britain's next prime minister today? We're down to three. It was just half an hour before the show. I was up here for the show that we had our latest candidate eliminated. I have her name later in my notes. I should have written it down further so that I got it right, because I can never remember her last name. This is it. It's all these people that none of us had really heard of very much before. Kemi Badenoch, she was the last to go. She was about the last reasonably right-wing person left in the competition. I don't know, it's hard to tell with so many of these people what they would be like in office, but she seemed one of the last reasonably right-wing people. She was the only person who talked at least about slowing down Britain's commitment to net zero, not stopping it, but just slowing down this dramatic push to cut climate emissions. And she is she has been the strongest about taking on kind of this woke movement and pushing back against that. She is now out anyway. We're left down to three people, all of whom seem fairly left-wing. It's going to keep on going. We'll have another person evicted tomorrow. Then we're down to the runoff phase between the final two, and that's where things slow down a bit. We'll have these two individuals will go out to the country, and they will talk to the ordinary Conservative voters. There are hundreds of thousands of Conservative voters up and down the country, and they will vote on which of these two they wish to be the next leader of the Conservative Party and therefore the next Prime Minister. So it's who makes it to the final two? It's a close race. It's hard to say who's going to make it into the final two. It depends now that Kemi Badenoch is out. Who's she going to give her votes to? That's kind of the big question. But really, I mean, without spending tons of time getting into the minutiae here, which I don't think it's really worth doing, you've just got people that do seem generally pretty vaguely left-wing. Rishi Sunak is the leader. I was watching his debate. He reminded me very much of Tony Blair, the Labour leader, from a couple of decades back. Penny Mordaunt is another one. I've been kind of baffled by her popularity. She's been very popular among the leadership, or among Conservative Party members. My theory there is that she's very good at looking strong and looking right wing. Trouble is, she's not actually that right wing. She's thoroughly into all the LGBT agenda. She's talked about how trans women are women and all this kind of thing. It does look like that has been finally catching up to her, and she's been slipping in polls as people kind of learn more about her. And then we've had Liz Truss, who kind of reminds me of Theresa May a bit, because she voted for Britain to stay in the EU, but then seems to have decided since then that the politically astute thing to do is to be a hardline Brexiteer. She may be the least bad of the last three. I don't really know. I don't choose. We might talk about towards the end of the show if we get time. Ultimately, it's God that puts in place these different leaders, and we can be confident it's all going to be what is best for what he wants and for his plan. But it's hard to know how serious or how genuine her conversion away from wanting to join the EU was. But talking about the European Union, Boris Johnson said something interesting yesterday in a debate. He's still in place. He's still there as a caretaker prime minister. And I thought this was an interesting statement to the House of Commons yesterday. This is clip three.
And some people will say, as I leave office, that this is the end of... They will say this is the end of Brexit. They will... Oh, yes. Listen to deathly hush. Deathly hush. And the leader of the opposition and the deep state will prevail in its plot to haul us back into alignment with the EU as a prelude to our eventual return. And we on this side of the House will prove them wrong, won't we?
So that was the first time in the deep state, I believe, the term deep state was used in the House of Commons. You know, we've talked about this before, the way so many government institutions want to keep Britain in the EU. And it's interesting to see the British Prime Minister admit this, talk about this. It makes you wonder whether there will be, as he talked about, more of a push maybe to get Britain back into the European Union. Last week, Trumpet Editor-in-Chief Gerald Flurry had a Trumpet brief talking about how the Bible indicates that the UK... the US, Israel, they're going to probably have a temporary resurgence together. And maybe there's a chance it's going to get worse before it gets better. You've got a very left-wing interim prime minister there in Israel, and maybe he'll try and do some damage before the elections. And I don't know, maybe we'll have something different, something like that in the UK. I don't think it will be very long before it all turns around. Mr. Flurry talked about that in that Trumpet brief. It could all turn around very quickly. I don't know, maybe it will get a little worse before it gets better. But anyway, I did just want to give a quick state of play, not spending too much time of it, on that leadership election. So we're down to the final three. I think we'll be down for the final two tomorrow. And then the competition is going to slow right down. And we're going to do a bit of an update on British news. I, of course, have to play this clip. This was everybody's favorite ex-royal, Prince Harry, at the United Nations yesterday.
This has been a painful year in a painful decade. We're living through a pandemic that continues to ravage communities in every corner of the globe. Climate change wreaking havoc on our planet, with the most vulnerable suffering most of all. The few weaponizing lies and disinformation at the expense of the many. And from the horrific war in Ukraine to the rolling back of constitutional rights here in the United States, we are witnessing a global assault on democracy and freedom, the cause of Mandela's life.
Yes, he was talking about or addressing on Nelson Mandela Day or something like that. But there he is saying that, well, America overturning Roe versus Wade, that's an attack on freedom and democracy around the world. According to Prince Harry, he says it's an attack on the Constitution. I don't know where I do know where he gets his ideas about the U.S. Constitution, his wife. But it's just sad to see it. It's very sad to see that. But it's a dramatic example of the decline of Britain's royal family, where you see Prince Charles out there talking about the pushing this ideology that is really harming Britain, harming the United States, this climate ideology. You then see Prince Harry out there pushing this idea that America is attacking freedom around the world and bringing down freedom around the world, and that somehow the Constitution, the founding fathers sat down and intended there to be a right to for women to murder babies, and that this is a terrible thing to have that removed. No, it is really it's a sad decline, and it's something again Trump editor in chief Gerald Fleurig forecast quite a few years ago now, that you would have a decline in Britain's royal family, and sadly it feels like we're seeing more and more news from that every day. You can read more about that in his book, A New Throne of David. And the great thing about that book is, you know, for anybody that loves the royal family, and there are a lot of people that love the royal family in the UK and even in the United States, there's a lot of people that respect the Queen, that respect the monarchy. And it is very sad to see that decline. But then that book just puts that decline in such a wonderfully hope-filled picture. I mean, the royal family was there to give hope and light to the world, and they're failing in that. But this book is just full of hope and shows where you can get, where there really is hope and light, and that God hasn't, you know, God is still there. God is the one that used this descendants of David, which is what the royal family descends from, to bring hope and light to the world. And he's still there. He's not affected by this decline of the royal family, by their decisions. And so he is still getting hope and getting vision out there. And this New Throne of David booklet will help you see that. It is just a wonderful antidote, I think, to so much of the discouraging news that we see going on, that I see going on in Britain. Well, we'll take a quick break now. When we get back, we'll give a bit of an update on a few pieces of European news. We'll be right back.
The Trumpet Daily. One third of your Bible is prophecy, and 90% of it is for our time today. This is why, when you study Bible prophecy, you often read statements like, in that day, in the last days, and at the time of the end. Biblical prophecy is what makes the Bible so relevant to today, so essential to understanding our modern world. Most people, even in the world of religion, assume that nations like Britain, America, Germany, Russia, and China are not mentioned in Bible prophecy. But if prophecy is mainly for our time today, how could the Bible ignore some of the most powerful and prominent nations of today? The key to understanding prophecy is knowing the biblical identities of modern nations. Learn about these identities in Herbert W. Armstrong's book, The United States and Britain in Prophecy. In this book, you will learn about the astonishing identity of the American and British people in biblical prophecies. Request your free copy today, The United States and Britain in Prophecy.
The Trumpet Daily.
Welcome back to the Trumpet Daily radio show. Like I said, we talked about some UK news. I wanted to talk a little bit about the economy now, especially Europe. I've got a bit from the US as well, a pretty shocking piece of economic news. I'll give you a quick update as well. I just had a look at the temperature in here over the break. We're at 87 degrees now in this TV studio. I've noticed the studio tends to kind of heat up in the evenings rather than the day. So there's my bit of complaint over the weather out the way. But as you would have heard on Friday's show, the latest news, we've got Mario Draghi in Italy poised to quit as the prime minister. He offered to resign last week, and that's still not resolved now. There's lots of going back and forth on if they can convince him to stay. There's all kind of jousting about. One group is saying, well, I'll support him, but only if this other group doesn't. Or then someone else says, well, I'll do it. I'll support him, but only if this other group does. And it gets very complicated very quickly. And it kind of comes down to, well, is this guy going to keep his word? And well, this guy doesn't want elections, but he also said that in this circumstance he would choose elections. So what's worse for him, to have elections now or to be called out or to be, you know, shown to be a liar and then have elections later? Lots and lots of back and forth, but we should find out exactly what's going on over the next couple of days. But this question as to what's going to happen to Italy has big implications for the EU. It's well worth watching Europe's economics right now. Well, it's worth watching economics anyway, but it's worth spending a little bit of time having a quick update here. Thomas Mayer, he's the ex-chief economist of Deutsche Bank. He wrote a book, Europe's Unfinished Currency. And he talked about how, he wrote, for almost 10 years, the ECB has been mutualizing public debt on its balance sheets and seems to have no consequences. So it's been for about 10 years, the European Central Bank has been going around buying Italian debt and German debt and French debt, etc. And the Italian government has been able to borrow money the way that it has because the European Central Bank is printing money and willing to buy it up. We can all see the effects with rising inflation and the falling euro, Mr. Mayer continued. The ECB can no longer disguise it. What the German people long feared is happening. Monetary union is degenerating into a common debt community. I don't think they will react until they are presented with the bill for what they thought was a free lunch. So this could go on for a long time. It's going to be a slow motion train wreck. So we're starting to get the possibility of the euro crisis emerging. And like he says there, it's not necessarily something that is going to completely fall about next week. But it's a good reminder that there's really the potential for an absolutely massive economic crisis still there in Europe. You know, you had this euro crisis start in 2008, getting underway in America. And things were a bit hairy for a while. It looked like the European Union might fall apart. But then eventually the European Central Bank, under Mario Draghi at the time, they managed to find a way to get away with printing enough money to paper over these problems. The problems are still there, though. Italy's debt has gotten bigger, much bigger, since the euro crisis. It's gone from 130% of the size of its economy to 150% of the size of its economy. It owes the EU 600 billion euros in the EU's interbank payment system. A lot of that is to Germany, which that system and that's the target two imbalance, again, tends to get very complicated. And as long as the euro stays together, doesn't really mean much, but it's a show of a lot of money leaving the country. But now, pretty much the same time that Draghi is in trouble with the ECB, the European Central Bank is being forced to stop printing money and buying up government debts. Yeah, they'd like to keep going. I think they would like to prop up the Italian government. But the only official reason that they have for printing money is to prevent deflation. You know, the opposite of inflation, where your money is worth more and more each year instead of being worth less and less. That sounds like a good thing. Some ways it is. It can cause a lot of problems, though, because it becomes impossible to pay off debts because you get kind of a cycle where the debt just gets bigger and bigger because that doesn't deflate away. Anyway, we won't go there. But the official reason is to stop deflation. Deflation is very clearly not a problem right now. Quite the opposite. We've got high inflation. So they've completely lost the excuse to keep printing money. So instead, they've got to raise interest rates, stop printing money, stop buying Italian government debt. And at the same time as you have this problem, you have Mario Draghi, this ex-central banker that the financial markets really respect, potentially being pushed out of office. And this could then lead to, another outbreak of the euro crisis. So the ECB has frantically been looking for an excuse to keep buying up government debts. But then their problem is that the German Constitution, if they've got pretty narrow limits, and if they go outside them, the German Constitutional Court will come in and strike that down. And so far, they've failed to bring that in. There is currently still a way to get a bailout. It's called the ESM. But to do that, you have to get permission from the German parliament and agree to submit to conditions. And of course, Italy doesn't want to do that. And their debt, their interest rate is rising higher and higher. I think we're around 3% now. And 5% is generally regarded at the moment as the danger zone for Italy. And at the same time that you're doing this, you have some potential for some big, big problems in Europe's energy situation. Foreign Policy had an article last week titled Energy Crisis, Europe's Worst Nightmare is Becoming Reality. They quote from Alex Munton. I guess he's an expert on global gas markets. He said, this is the most extreme energy crisis that has ever occurred in Europe. Europe is looking at the very real prospect of not having sufficient gas when it is most needed, which is during the coldest part of the year. And he talked about how prices, well, he said prices have shot through the roof. So he was writing that last week. Since then, Russia has switched off Nord Stream 1. This is their gas pipeline to Germany. It's been closed for maintenance. But now Russia, especially, they kind of threatened a little bit before they shut it down. Now it is shut down. They're talking more and more about not opening it again. That has massive potential for economic problems if they cut Germany off on their gas. Now, Euro Intelligence, they talk about that they had. I thought this was some interesting quotes where they talked about the chance of a dirty deal with Putin. They said, we expect the Germans to take Russia's blackmail very seriously. Despite official denials, we believe there is intense pressure within the government for a dirty deal with Putin. You, the Russians, keep the gas flowing. We, the Germans, commit to buying your gas at least 10 years. But we won't tell anyone now. Nobody will care when this becomes clear in 2 years' time. This is not what the Germans will ever admit, not even privately. This outlet went on to write, if Europe keeps the gas flowing, this conflict won't boil over. Also, we should not underestimate the pressure Scholz is under from German industry. They tell him every day that the German industrial model depends for its survival on the kindness of dictators. And then a bit further on, he said, if the gas miraculously comes back on at the end of next week, we know for sure that Putin received ironclad assurances from his German friends. So we've talked before about the potential for Germany and Russia having done a deal. I'm sure there's still a lot of details to be worked out. A lot of even friction within that deal is the Ukraine crisis drags on probably longer than both sides expected. It wasn't the short war that they thought it would be. And so there's probably still a few more things to work out, a bit of friction to be sorted, and that's probably what's driving some of this. So, you know, maybe they'll work something out, maybe they won't. But in context with the euro crisis, my point is this is another potential economic crisis for Europe. This massive now potential gas shortage, and there's German gas companies going bust at the moment. There's energy companies that are thinking they're going to run out of fossil fuels. There's fertilizer companies, chemical giants that are not going to be able to manufacture the chemicals that they're used to. And this could cause massive economic pressure too. I think I pointed to this last time I was on the show, but Spiegel had an article, German Prosperity at Risk, where they talked about, is the German model of prosperity in danger? There is much to suggest the crisis could create difficulties for the middle class here. Politicians are viewing the situation with great concern because the middle class is a pillar of support for the state and democracy with its political convictions, its commitment to work, and its desire for stability. If the middle class falters, so too could everything else. No one knows what might happen if prosperity dwindles drastically. So you could have big political changes coming to Germany driven by some of these different economic crises. Certainly keep watching, keep looking for a strongman in Europe. Like we've said before, we pointed you to Karl Theodor zu Gutenberg. And I mentioned him last time I was on the show. I got an update just at the end of last week where he really does seem to be kind of leaning into this media career that he's launching right now in Germany. So he is going to be this individual that we've been watching for a long time as a potential strong leader of Germany. He's going to be taking on a very public role on German TV now. It'll be very interesting to see where that brings him. So we could be seeing some big political changes in Germany. There are people talking about big political changes in Europe. Remember, one of Europe's founding fathers, Jean Monnet, famously said, Europe will be forged in crises and will be the sum of the solutions adopted for those crises. Now, the European Union founding fathers, the people that designed this, most of them Catholics in the stages even of being made saints by the Catholic Church, they knew how this would move forwards. You know, they knew that... When they got the euro together, they knew that they couldn't get all the different nations of Europe to agree to come together and become a massive superstate, that voters would never vote for that. They would never agree to share an army with the country next door. But they believed in this project passionately. And so they came up with these stages. Okay, well, we'll make it a trading relationship. And none of this is conjecture. This is all very well documented. They went through and they wrote about this. And I read you that quote from Monet just now. Okay, well, we'll get this together as a trading relationship. And as we have it as a trading relationship, well, then we can open the doors for travel. We can build joint infrastructure projects to connect our countries together more. We can gradually then bring in different rules about our products and then harmonizing working conditions, bring in all of these things that get us closer to being a super state. And then another major step is where we can have a currency. And again, even at the point when it comes to bringing in a common currency, they couldn't get all 27 nations in Europe to sit down and agree to become a super state. So it's like, okay, well, then we'll build a currency and we'll share a currency and we'll tell people, nope, we're still not a super state. You're sharing a currency. But when you're sharing a currency, but having different governments with different taxing and different spending policies, then you get this situation where Italy can have, you know, Italy used to always have a mess of a government, always have governments falling apart. And then their currency would just keep getting weaker and weaker and weaker. And that was just Italy. Now, if Italy tries to do that, well, their currency is the euro. And Germany doesn't like this idea of this euro constantly inflating and getting weaker and weaker. They're dead against that. So you start to immediately get some friction. Germany has a lot of the power, so they stop that from happening. Well, now Italy can't deal with its debts. It can't function. It's heading to bankruptcy. It was all very predictable. And these leaders of Europe knew that it would happen. They knew that the euro would be a crisis-making machine. Bernard Coligny wrote about that in his book, The Rotten Heart of Europe. And their thinking was a currency without a state, a superstate behind it, a common currency without a superstate, it cannot work. It's always going to cause these kind of crises. So we'll bring about the euro, we'll bring about the current currency, and the common government will have to follow. They'll have no choice. They'll be keeping on confronted with these crises. And if it fails, they'll all fall apart, or they'll all come together as a superstate, and we believe they're all going to come together as a super state. They knew that this would happen. And it raises the interesting prospect that, do these German businesses that pushed for the deal with Russia, maybe they don't mind a bit of an energy crisis either right now. Trumpet editor-in-chief Gerald Flurry talks about their motives in the July Trumpet print edition, Germany's secret deal with Russia exposed. You know, they're all on board with having major political changes in Germany, bringing in a new authoritarian style of leadership to Germany, political crisis in Germany, a new European superstate. Maybe they don't have a problem with a bit of an energy crisis right now if they're convinced that it's going to advance their goals. But you already see political changes being put forward. The German Chancellor, Olaf Scholz, he wrote an article recently for the Frankfurt Allgemeine Zeitung, a German magazine. And he talked about that. He said he was putting forward concrete proposals for getting rid of the veto in foreign policy. So right now, the European Union finds it very hard to act as a superstate on the world scene. Big reason for that is that any one country can veto the EU's foreign policy. So even if they want to condemn a country, one country in the EU can say, nope, veto, don't want that to happen. It makes it impossible for them to conduct foreign policy, so it doesn't happen. And instead, foreign policy is left to the individual member states. If they can get rid of that, though, it's a massive leap towards being a superstate, and they'll be able to speak with one voice, and they'll be able to get involved in areas where they haven't been able to get involved in before. So he talks about having the EU becoming a geopolitical player. He wrote, permanent disagreement, permanent dissent between the member states weaken us. So he said that this must be the end of the selfish blockades of European decisions by individual member states. He talked about how the EU reacted to Russia's invasion of Ukraine with unprecedented determination and unity. And so he said, this should continue. He said that to continue in areas like building a European defense or with technological sovereignty. He said, Germany will make concrete suggestions for the next few months. National vetoes we can simply no longer afford if we want to be held in a world of competing major powers. And he's definitely not the only person in Germany talking like this. The chairman of his political party, the SPD, Lars Kleinbeil, he talked about this as well back in June. He said the EU must be able to act quickly, so it needs to abolish the principle of unanimity, for example, in foreign policy. He said Germany can only be strong if Europe is strong. He said that Germany has been reluctant after almost 80 years to have a role in the international coordination system. He said that Germany must have the right to be a leading power. And he said that military violence should also be seen as a legitimate means of politics. It's interesting. 15 years ago or so, maybe it was 20 years ago, someone was fired for, they lost their job. I think it was the president or the defense minister. I think it was the president for saying pretty much exactly that, that Germany must be a leading power, that Germany must be use military violence as a means of policy. They had to resign because of those statements. Now, this SDP chairman says it barely even makes the news. Germany has changed. But they're pushing to pushing to get rid of this veto is interesting. You know, Germany has, well, when it's not done by veto, when the EU doesn't require everybody to agree on something, they all vote on it, and the voting is weighted by population. Germany is Europe's most populous state, so Germany gets most of the votes. Well, not most of the votes, but the largest number of votes. And it makes it very easy for them to dominate. And they know that. When there was talk of Ukraine joining the EU, Ukraine has a population of 45 million, not as much as Germany's, but that's still a big addition to the EU. And Germany said, nope, not going to happen unless we can have some changes to the voting laws so we don't see our voting power diluted. Then we'll agree to it. But that's our condition. We don't want to see our voting powers diluted. So eliminating the veto puts Germany much more firmly as the most populous nation, puts them much more firmly in the driving seat. It makes it possible for the EU to act as a super state. It puts Germany in command there. And so to kind of connect this all together, Euro Intelligence, their recommendation, I thought it was a fascinating one, said, well, the smaller nations of Europe should turn around and say, okay, Germany, yes, we'll give up the veto on one condition. We want you, Germany, to let the European Central Bank bail us out. Ultimately, we want your economy in some way standing behind our debt. If you do that, then we'll give up the veto and we'll turn the EU into the super state. We'll let you control the foreign policy of that super state. But you need to, you know, help support our debt and you need to help defend us. It's interesting that they're putting that forward, that we're kind of inching closer and closer to this grand bargain that would create a super state where he's basically saying, well, the smaller countries of Europe should hand over Europe to Germany in exchange for Germany backing their economies. It's still a big step. Are we there yet? Maybe not quite. Maybe things will have to get a bit worse in Europe. But it is, like I said, fascinating. People see them talking about this grand bargain, because this is exactly what Trumpeter-in-Chief Gerald Flurry said, exactly what Mr. Armstrong forecast. In 1984, Mr. Armstrong wrote that an economic crisis beginning in America could suddenly result in triggering European nations to unite as a new world power larger than either the Soviet Union or the United States. That's what could well trigger this, an economic crisis. And you see Europe potentially now moving into an economic crisis, one that the Biden administration has a large role to play in. Now, he was making this prophecy because of what the Bible talks about in Revelation 17, that forecasts this rise of a beast power in Europe that rises and falls again and leads to a union of 10 nations who shall have one mind and give their power and strength to this beast, as it says in Revelation 7 and verse 13. But Trumpeter-in-Chief Gerald Flurry commenting on this, he said, what will cause these nations to unite so forcefully? It is very difficult to unite nations into one mind. That's an incredibly challenging undertaking. Mr. Armstrong had profound insight in specially forecasting that the catalyst for this dramatic unification would be a massive financial crisis that starts in America and ripples out from there. Look at conditions in America and the world today, and it's not difficult to see just how right he was. He concluded, watch the economic situation in America closely and its effect on Europe. That's why I wanted to give an update on what's going on in Europe here. Mr. Flurry said, well, watch closely the effect of this financial crisis on Europe. And just to continue that quote and see if this dramatic prophecy from Mr. Armstrong doesn't come to pass just as he said it would. and we can keep watching this dramatic moment in Bible prophecy. Well, I'll probably have to set aside my Bible study. I need to find ways to not talk about British politics for as long. But I will still use the time remaining. I've got one more news story I'll slip in instead, rather than try and rush through the Bible study in 6 minutes, where we've got another economic story, another insane decision, maybe on the same level as the Netherlands and the farming that we talked about last time I was on the show, but this time in the United States, where the radical left is wanting much more control now over the U.S. Federal Reserve. The Democrats are pushing a new bill called the Federal Reserve Racial and Economic Equality Act. It's gone through the House. It will be going to the Senate. It might not make it through the Senate. There's a good chance, I guess, that it won't. But it would still, if it goes through, it will force on some pretty radical changes. So right now, the Federal Reserve has a legal mandate. Its job, it has a twofold job: to foster maximum employment and stable prices. Those are its targets: maximum employment, stable prices. So low inflation, low unemployment. This would create a third mandate, a third task for the Federal Reserve. Quote, the elimination of disparities across racial and ethnic groups with respect to employment, income, wealth, and access to affordable credit. So in some ways that sounds laudable. Nobody wants discrimination, I guess. It doesn't say discrimination, it says disparities. But nobody wants people to be discriminated because of racial or ethnic lines or anything like that. But it would give the task to the Federal Reserve. Now, is the Federal Reserve doing a good job on its original mandate? So people looking at the Federal Reserve and saying, well, you're obviously doing such a great job on controlling inflation and keeping unemployment low. We need to give you something else to do. Well, quite clearly not. But they want to give them this massive additional task. And there are some pretty big disparities. I should have brought the stats between some of the different races. But none of that is because of the Federal Reserve. You know, interest rates aren't racist. And having the Federal Reserve legally obliged to consider race could lead us into all kinds of dangerous territory. Apparently, those in Washington, well, no, it's deliberate. If it was accident, they'd have the memory of goldfish. I think they do know what they're doing. But this is a big part of what caused the subprime mortgage crisis in the back in 2008. This same crisis that set off all of these different events in Europe, where you had the Freddie Mae or Fannie Mae, Freddie Mac, these two entities involved in the mortgage markets in the U.S., and then you had the Clinton administration starting to get concerned about the same kind of thing, well, racial inequalities in house ownership. And so they started setting goals for these federal institutions of, okay, well, you've got to lend 30% to people with low income. Well, now it's got to be 50% of loans going to people with a low income. Stanley Kurtz, he wrote this in the National Review some years ago. Finally, in June of 1995, President Clinton, Vice President Gore, and Secretary Cisneros announced the administration's comprehensive new strategy for raising home ownership in America to an all-time high. Representatives from ACORN, this radical leftist group, were guests of honor at the ceremony. In his remark, Clinton emphasized that our home ownership strategy will not cost the taxpayer one extra cent. It will not require legislation. Clinton meant that informal partnerships between Fannie and Freddie and groups like ACORN would make mortgages available to customers who have historically been excluded from home ownership. So you had the mandatory targets for these government institutions involving eliminating racial disparities. And what happened? Well, to do that, they lowered lending standards. Tons of people took out loans that they couldn't afford. If they're lowering lending standards for those at the bottom end of the income scale, they're lowering lending standards for everybody. So wealthy companies and businesses took out loans that they couldn't afford. You had a massive expansion of subprime mortgage loans, and it all exploded. That's not the whole story. It's a bit of an oversimplification, but it shows just how dangerous this push now that would see the Federal Reserve get involved in racial politics can be. Another story to keep an eye on as the radical left just advances through all of these different deep state institutions. Well, that really is all that we've got time for. Thank you for joining us here on today's show. You can call the program if you want to request any of the literature we mentioned at 1-866-930-3024, or you can email the show at td@thetrumpet.com.